here.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a boat, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. It's actually sunny outside, but it's only 20 degrees, but don't let that bother you. We are live. This is MJ Network. This is your host, Fran Lewis, and I am so excited. We have the author of the Andy Carpenter series, which is one of my favorites. David Rosenfeld is here, and Deck the Hounds. Good morning. How are you? How is it over where you are? Are you freezing, too?
20 degrees sounds balmy compared to where I am. I'm in Maine.
Oh, nice. Well, we're expecting a horrible snowstorm tomorrow, but that won't stop me anyway. So, the Andy Carpenter series is one of my favorites, and he's really got a unique personality. He reminds me a lot of other characters, but mostly he reminds me of the fact he's very sarcastic, he's very straightforward, and you have to love him. So how did you create him? And is he a touch of David Rosenfeld?
Yeah, he's... I created him from a combination of things. I wanted to write a courtroom drama, and I was writing TV movies, and they weren't making them. So I decided to write a novel. And because I'm not that creative, I chose as a main character somebody like myself. So Andy is, you know, he's obnoxious. He's sarcastic. He's badgering. He doesn't understand women. He's all of those things, which is like me, but he's also a lawyer, and he's younger and thinner than I am. So he has my perspective on life, if not necessarily my biography.
He's so cool, though. What I love about the books is that I love his little asides, his little statements, his little sarcastic statements, so you really know what he's thinking.
I wrote screenplays for a long time. And novels are much freer in that they sort of let you do that. You know, you could take some time to give your perspective on the world. When you write screenplays, every page is like gold, and every page something has to happen to move the plot forward. Novels, not so much. Novels, you can learn more about the character in a more leisurely way.
Yeah, I reviewed screenplays, and they're not very difficult to review 120 pages.
Right.
And you get, you know, I could read it depends on the book. You see, your books are great because the font, I could see it. I've been getting books with fonts like one font, two font, and I could read 400 pages in an hour. And then when the book has a font that's so small, I want to, oh my God, that's when I put it on the side and go, look, it could wait. So how did he meet Laurie? And I get the feeling that, you know, Andy thinks he's running the show, but I don't know about that. And tell us about Ricky. I love those characters. I love the little boy. He's great.
Laurie is his wife. He met. Real authors, and I don't necessarily consider myself a real author because I started writing late in life, but real authors take the time to learn all about their characters, even the things that aren't on the page. Me, not so much. I'm not that interested in what I'm not writing. So in the first book called Open and Shut, he already knew Laurie. She was a former cop, and she was an investigator. He's a criminal defense attorney. So not only had they already met, but they were already having an affair. So I'm assuming that, you know, she opened up a private investigation firm, which I know she did after she left the force, and he hired her. And then their romantic attachment came from there. Ricky was in one of the books, I think it was Hounded, but I'm not sure. His father was killed, is murdered. And Andy and Laurie took Ricky in as a foster basis to get him over this horrible period. He was, I think, 8 years old. and they wound up falling in love with him, and he was perfect for the family. And actually, in that book is when Andy and Lori got married, and simultaneous with getting married, they adopted Ricky.
I love Ricky. But I love these books, really. I think I've read just about every book that you've written, and I think I've reviewed every book.
Thank you.
It's funny because if I see it on Facebook, it's very rare that I'll ask an author directly, can I have your book to review? Because I have like a stack inside that's taller than my 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's one of yours, what can I say? So Andy is a lawyer. And this is really what's cool. He's very rich but doesn't need to take on clients. So how does he get roped into taking these cases in every single book? Well, this one in Deck the Hounds, he's helping the homeless guy. And that's very prevalent with what's going on in the news, I mean, constantly. So how does he get roped into taking the cases when he doesn't really have to take it and he doesn't really need the money?
And he doesn't really want to work. But the
I know.
The trick, the thing is, in my books, what happens is in real life, I'm a dog lunatic. And in fact, at any moment now, you could hear barking break out. I'm in my office with 11 large dogs. So I made Andy a dog lunatic, and I gave him, we have a dog rescue foundation, so Andy has a dog rescue foundation. So I think it was the sixth book called Play Dead. The books were doing okay, and they were getting good reviews and some awards, and they were just doing okay. And then all of a sudden, Play Dead, not only did Andy have a dog, but the plot was centered on a dog. A dog led Andy into the case. And so the publisher put a golden retriever on the cover, and the book sold twice as many copies as any previous one. So I decided they would all have dogs on the cover. So so the key is for me is a dog leads Andy into the case. Andy's love of dogs, something happens. Like the homeless guy you just described in Deck of Hounds had a dog with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that spikes Andy's interest, and then it becomes something else, and it's not about the dog necessarily, but the dog leads him into the case. And the dogs are, in these books, the dogs are dogs. I mean, they don't talk and they don't solve crimes and so on. They're dogs. But Andy's like I say, he's like me, and his love of dogs definitely comes through.
Well, I like Zoe, and I felt so bad for her in the book at the beginning.
You don't have to feel that, because, trust me, nothing bad will ever happen to a dog in one of my books. In fact, Andy's dog is named Tara, which was our original dog in life. And people email me, and they tell me that they go into a bookstore, and they pick up the new book, and they skim to the end to see if Tara's name is near the end so they can be sure that she's not going to die in the book. And no dog will ever die or get hurt. People don't care if I kill off 100 people, but if a dog hurts his paw, it's a disaster. So that's never going to happen.
You know, it's funny that you should say that, because I interviewed Tess Gerritsen last month, and her movie, her horror movie, Island Zero, the original beginning that I saw related to a dog getting killed, and she changed it because people were carrying on that. Yeah, she changed it. The movie is scary as anything, but
it's a disaster.
It.
You can't do it. I mean, you just can't do it.
It was the downfall of the movie. So I said, I'm glad you changed it, because the movie was really scary. Oh my god.
Yeah.
So tell us about this Tara Foundation and who helps you. Who helps Andy run it? Because that's interesting too.
I'm sorry, the real life one or the Andy one? I didn't hear what you said.
Whichever one you like.
The Tara Foundation, the real one, was my wife and I lived in California, and we had a dog named Tara. She had a dog named Tara when I met her, a golden retriever who was the greatest dog in the history of the world. And she got cancer and died. And my wife wasn't ready to get another dog, so we started volunteering in animal shelters. And the shelters in L.A. are just horrible, absolutely horrible. So it became too passive for us to sit there and watch dogs get put down and watch them get adopted for the wrong reasons as guard dogs or whatever. So we started our own foundation, and we called it the Tara Foundation, and we rescued about 4,000 dogs through it. Oh, here we go.
Oh, hi, guys.
On
key. Hold
on.
I can tell you.
Sorry.
Thank you so much.
I think they, hold on, I'm hiding in the laundry room now. I think they must have seen an animal outside, or if FedEx pulls up, it sounds like a fox hunting here.
Oh, hi, guys.
And we live in the middle of nowhere, because when you have all these dogs, you can't, we have 17 now, and that's low for us. But when you have all these dogs, you can't have neighbors, so we live in the middle of nowhere. But FedEx does come up. So anyway, in fact, once I did a live radio interview with I think it was for a station in Seattle, and they were barking mm-hmm. like crazy, and I actually went upstairs into the exercise room, into a closet, and closed the door, and I told the guy where I was, and I told him that it'll be the first time in radio history that an author has come out of the closet live on his show. Anyway, I lost my train of thought. Where was I? What was it? Oh, so anyway, so we rescued about 4,000 dogs. And, you know, if a dog was too sick or ill or old or whatever, epileptic or blind, we couldn't place them in a home, so they came home and there's our dog. So we always have a house full of old or ill dogs. Andy, he came into all this money, and he was looking for a charity, so I gave him the Tara Foundation. So he has a rescue foundation in the books. And it's also a way for him to get involved with certain dogs that lead him into cases.
Well, that is great. My niece does that. She owns a rescue mission. She just works with rescue dogs in Long Island. It's mm-hmm. called Perfect Poor Mass. So she actually does it. My brother has a rescue dog.
Mm-hmm.
And because everybody needs a middle name, and he only named her Bella, so I call her Bella Bella.
Oh, yeah.
And she's a Rottweiler pit bull. She's hot stuff. And if she's
we have pretty much every
yeah.
type, but we only have large dogs.
Yeah,
so we have a bunch of golden retrievers. We have two mastiffs. We have some labs. We have Bernese. A Newfoundland and a bunch of large mutts.
So how do they get along? Seriously.
They get along no problem. You know, absolutely no problem. Trainers are amazed. Trainers say we could never do something like this. I mean, when we lived in California, when we were actively mm-hmm. rescuing, we never had less than 30 dogs in the house. And,
oh, my God.
And it's completely psychotic, but it works fine. It really does.
And you get to walk all of them and everything? Or
no,
does somebody
no, no,
do
no,
it
no,
for you?
No. We're on about 12 acres on a lake, and we fence mm-hmm. off about 3 of the acres, and then there's a doggy door the size of the Lincoln Tunnel, and they can go in and out as they please and walk around mm-hmm. in the woods. But they're not really – I mean, these are older, sick dogs, right? I mean, they're,
mm-hmm.
you know, probably – except for a couple, our youngest dog is probably 9. And, you know, so they're not really looking to go for long walks. They just go outside in the morning and they amble mm-hmm. around and do their constitutionals and then come back in.
Oh, that is good. That is great.
It's great unless you have to actually live like this.
Well, you decided. What can I say?
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know how many people would do what you're doing. I doubt it. I strongly doubt that so many people would do. And do you tend to take more dogs, get more?
Yeah, what it is now is we live in Maine, and the rescue situation in New England is fantastic. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
it's the opposite of Southern California or the South. And in fact, hundreds of dogs are brought up here every week from down south
mm.
to be placed in homes. So they don't really need us to place dogs in homes here, but they
mm.
do come up with dogs that they can't place for whatever reasons. So, you know, if a dog has cancer or if a dog
mm.
is blind, or like recently we got a 6-year-old pit bull mix that has terrible separation anxiety and very bad epilepsy. They're called grand mal seizures.
Mm.
So, you know, nobody's going to take him. So we took him. So, you know, so shelters around here know to call us when they have a dog that they
mm.
can't place, but we don't have to actively look for any.
That's amazing. So in this particular book, which I love, I just sat down and read it, seriously. And then it's really funny because I got the one that you sent me, And then I got another one from your publisher. And when my doctor found out that I had it, he immediately took it out of my hand. I mean, I don't have to even say a word. And when I told them, I told some people yesterday that you were going to come on the show, everybody was slipping out. They're like, oh, my God, that is the greatest. I love his series. You've got a lot of fans out there. Trust me.
Except you should make your doctor buy the book. He's your doctor. Make him buy the book.
Yeah, well, I explained. He explained to me I never have to wait for an appointment in his
Okay. So you're using it. Okay.
I just have to call and say, this is Fran. I've got reading material for Dr. M. And they go, just come.
I do the same with our
vet. I've got a few more. Yeah, what can I say? He thinks I'm great. What can I tell you? So, in this particular book, why did you choose Christmas as the season? And what are Andy's family's traditions? Because that was different, too.
Why did I choose Christmas as the season? I can't say I actually chose Christmas. What happened was the year before, or 2 years before, I forget which, my publisher called and said they do, with their authors, they occasionally have their authors write a Christmas book. And would I like to do one? So I did. It was, I think it was 2 years ago, and it was called 12 Dogs of Christmas. And it did really well. I mean, by my standards, it did terrifically well. So they asked me if I would write another one, which, you know, so it was meant to be a Christmas book. What happens is I have a book come out in March every year, which is a thriller that's not an Andy Carpenter book. Then I have a Andy Carpenter book come out in July. So the only time of year open is around Christmas. So these were Christmas books going in. So Deck the Hounds just came out. That was a Christmas book. And now I've agreed to write one for this coming Christmas, which I don't even know what it's about yet, but I'll be starting to write it soon.
I didn't know you had another series because they don't send those to me.
Yeah, it's called the. What happened was every year I started to write a thriller with different characters. And
nice.
I think the sixth or seventh one, I wrote one called Blackout, which had a cop named Doug Brock was the main character. And the book was really well received, and everybody liked the character. So instead of doing new characters every year, now we do a Doug Brock book every year. So the third one is coming out in this March, and it's called Black and Blue, and it's coming out in March.
I'll send to Hector. Don't worry. I'm on it.
Okay.
Seriously. I'll just add it to, I have a pile of 25 books on my chair that are all coming out in February and March. And everybody expects me to read them by
the... He's different than Andy, but sort of the same in his perspective on life. And certainly there's some humor. There's humor in there like there is in Andy books, though not as dramatic. You know, not as much of it.
I love books that make me smile, though. But this one, I mean, we have the homeless guy, Don Carrigan. And what really is great is that he didn't have to do this, but kindness around Christmas time, it's really nice that he did this, that, you know, that Andy took him in. So Andy thinks that, you know, he works for himself, but actually Lori works for him. But we know that she runs the show, right? I mean,
yeah,
he
and
thinks she runs
in,
the show,
in this case, she brings him into it. Like she's, you know, he's like a curmudgeon type. And she gets him to do the right thing, even though we hope that he eventually would anyway, but she's his conscience.
Yeah, but how do you allow somebody that you don't know that lives on the street to come and live in upstairs?
Well, I didn't. My
I was
character
like, yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know.
Well, he
I
lived in
it.
They put him in the apartment above the garage, right? They have an apartment above the garage. Yeah.
And he let him live there, and he didn't even think that, you know, how you know he could, you know, do that, whatever. Yeah, so that's amazing. And he had you explained PTSD in the book also, and the use of Xanax. That's kind of dangerous too, with people.
Yeah, PTSD is just. I mean, I have a bunch of friends who suffer with it. It's just awful. I'm just absolutely awful.
Well, the other character that you have to talk about, because I love her, is Edna.
Edna's
great, because she doesn't do anything, but yet...
That's the whole point of Edna.
What does he keep her? She doesn't do anything.
That's the whole point. My characters have I sort of substitute character development by injecting eccentricity into them. And Edna is a his secretary who has self-elevated her title to office manager, who does absolutely no work at all. And she dreads the concept of Andy taking on a client. And she's also one of the world's leading crossword puzzle aficionados. Mm-hmm. And so I did that in the book. So I talked about her being a great crossword puzzle solver. And I got an email from a judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, who's a major player in the crossword field. He creates puzzles for the New York Times. He's a serious mm-hmm. player. And so I was down there speaking, and he invited me over, and he showed me how it's done, and he invited me to the National Crossword Puzzle Tournament, which I want to go to. I haven't gone to yet. It's apparently an amazing thing. I've seen footage of it. I mean, that's our mastiff barking. I think it's either in Brooklyn. It's in Brooklyn some years, and it's in Stamford, Connecticut some years, and it's like this intense, incredibly nerve-wracking thing. I mean, look, you have to do these puzzles in no time at all. And if you make a mistake, forget it. It's over. So it's actually a remarkable thing. But anyway, so Edna entered 1 year, and I think she came in eighth.
That's amazing, because I often wonder how they create the puzzles.
It's cool. Yeah, they have a computer program. And I mean, I don't know how they did it back in the day, but they have a computer program. You showed me the whole thing. It's actually pretty cool.
That's really amazing. So the other character that I would definitely want around if I was in big trouble and needed help would be Marcus Clark. And nobody messes with him. How come? I like him.
Yeah,
I
may have ripped him off unintentionally from, he's very different, but from the Hawk character in Spencer. In the Spencer books. But Marcus is he's sort of a superhero. He's an investigator who is always called on to protect the cowardly Andy. And he speaks in one-word syllables. But he's like, behind the scenes, like he's an interesting guy. Like we find out things as we go along. Like he goes to Vegas all the time, and he likes classical music. And all of these things are things you would never expect of Marcus. So my agent at one point, because everybody loves Marcus, and my agent suggested I write a book with Marcus as the lead character, but there's just not enough there. I mean, I don't think I could do it.
I don't know. You probably could figure it out. Maybe he can be Andy's sidekick and help in court or something like that.
Well, he never talks. Like he speaks only in one syllable. You know, so it'd be pretty tough to do a whole book with him. Here we go again. Sorry.
Okay, guys, I promise I'll be
back in the laundry room. Yeah, they definitely
see
something
outside. You want to be on the show too?
Yeah, what happens is we have wild turkeys that come up to the house, and they drive the dogs insane, absolutely insane.
Well, I had gone to somewhere the other day, and one of the yogurt places, and there was a turkey right in front.
Yeah, we have whole families of them. We have whole families.
I have no idea what it was doing in where I am, but it was in Scarsdale, and the turkey was coming into the yogurt place, and I go, "Do you really want yogurt?" And it didn't look like a very healthy turkey either. It looked like he was not well, and I was like, "Oh my God!" And then we went somewhere else, and it was the same turkey. He sort of moved across the street. Like, "Oh my God!"
Turkeys here are actually apparently fairly dangerous. Like, if a dog ever went up to them, they might regret that they did.
And I wasn't going to find out.
They can't get to our dogs because it's fenced in.
As a matter of fact, he landed on somebody's car. And when the guy came out, he couldn't get in the car because the turkey wasn't letting him in the car. It's like, oh, my God, I don't want to go there. So Andy's really good. So how does he deal with the media, and how does he deal with the police with any case? I mean, this was the case of a homeless guy, but how does he deal with them? I mean, he seems to be able to not have a problem.
Well, I mean, they're adversaries. They all hate him. The only cop that doesn't hate him is his best friend, Andy's best friend, actually, who he goes to a sports bar with I used to go every night. Now that he's married, he goes 3 times a week. But there's a guy named Pete Stanton, who's a homicide captain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Andy's best friend, even though they have a insulting, you know, they keep insulting each other. But the rest of the cops hate Andy because not only is he a defense attorney, so he's their natural enemy, but he often embarrasses them on the witness stand. So he gets along with the cops, but at arm's length for sure.
Well, how does he deal with judges then? Do they hate him too when
they
he walks
hate
in the
him,
court?
Yeah, they probably hate him more than defense attorney than cops do, because Andy's style is to be unconventional at the least and flamboyant maybe at the most. But so he pushes the envelope, and he's, you know, the thing I like about I love writing courtroom scenes, and what happens is Andy's. You know, it's an environment where the lawyer can be badgering and sarcastic and obnoxious, you know, all the things I am in real life, and he can do as part of it, can do as part of his job. So I love writing those scenes, but they piss off judges.
I won't tell you my opinion of dealing with lawyers lately. Oh boy. Sometimes I want to give them a plug to plug in their brain to listen to what people say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously. And sometimes it's just like, oh, my God, why am I even bothering? So how do you decide on the type of case to give him? Well, we know he doesn't want to do anything, but how did he get so rich? I mean, seriously.
Oh, in the first book, his father, I mean, it's too long a story to go into now, but his father dies and winds up leaving Andy, I think, like $22 or $25 million that Andy never knew he had, and he never touched it for 35 years, the father.
Okay.
And there's a whole story behind that. But then at the beginning of book two, and it was money that was earned dishonorably. At the beginning of book two, I was going to have Andy give the money back because of the way the father got it. And then I decided it could be funnier if Andy decided to try and find charities to give the money to. So I had some fun with that. And then I had Andy start the dog rescue. So it turned out to be very lucky for me. I sort of blundered into it because the fact that Andy kept the money enables him to pick and choose which cases he does. So therefore he can only, for instance, he'll only take on clients he thinks are innocent, that kind of thing. And having the money gives him the freedom to do that. But I was very lucky that it happened that way.
I think Andy was very happy that you let it happen that way, too.
Yeah, Andy was fine.
I know. So in this particular book, we're dealing with a homeless guy. What made you decide that you would do something like that? And then when somebody tried to beat up this guy, I was not very happy.
Well, what's the last thing you said? I'm
people
sorry.
That have no choice but to live on the street, or in some cases they just do want to live on the street, and it's sad.
Yeah, it's an awful situation. But in terms of how did you ask? I'm sorry, did you ask how I came up with the idea? Is that
how did you come up with the idea of using a homeless guy?
I have no idea how I came up with the idea. I never know. I can never answer that question. And in fact, I sort of don't come up with an idea. Like, I'll come up with a setting, and usually it involves a dog, but the story I just do as I go along. So there's never any one moment. Like, I'm doing that right now in a book, and I can't think ahead, so there's never any one moment when I come up with an idea. It's sort of like I'm just putting one foot in front of the other, and at the end of it, it hopefully had an idea to it. You know, has a structure and a plot. But it's never something that I know before the fact.
That's interesting. The part I really like is that, although, like I said before, are the little asides that Andy, you know, all of a sudden out of nowhere he'll just say something.
Uh-huh.
You know, I find myself, with this book, I have the book in front of me, I underline too. I have myself to be of two minds, or the Kerrigan says, but he answers him. I mean, you never know. You know, what Andy's going to say. How do you come up with those asides and those sarcastic remarks? They're hilarious.
Yeah, that's sort of just me. It is the part that I like the best. I'm writing serious books in that, you know, a lot of people die. There's murders. You know, they're serious in a lot of ways. And yet when I finish, what I care about most is how many funny lines there were, you know, and I go back and I look for them and I'm pleased when I find them. And, you know, so it shouldn't necessarily be that way because that's not what these books are supposed to be about. But those asides and those things Andy says are my favorite part of the books. I literally wouldn't be writing them if that wasn't in there.
Well, first on page 247, this is hilarious, about Pete Stanton. I expect Pete to ridicule what I am saying as the rantings of a criminal defense attorney, but he doesn't. I mean, like, he's like, yeah, this is what I'm thinking, but this is what might happen, and I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen. And then he introduces other characters. This is hilarious. So who is Sam? It's another character in the book that I like.
Sam is his accountant. But he's also a computer genius, and he can hack into anything, legally or illegally. And what happened was, in the second book, they used to do a thing called song talking, he and Sam, where they were talking song lyrics. And it was part of a game to sneak song lyrics into the conversation without the other person realizing it. And what happened was, in the early on in book two, Sam dies. He gets killed. He got killed. And... but the publisher liked the song talking so much that we changed it. We let him stay alive, and we created some assistant for him who got killed. So that's the only reason that Sam exists today. But he's gradually developed over time into a crucial member of Andy's team because of his ability to hack into things and, you know, things like he can hack into the phone company's computers, and if you have somebody, you know, your phone has a GPS in it, so the phone company can look back for months and know where your phone was at every minute of every day. So that's a valuable tool for law enforcement. You know, I mean, you're not necessarily with your phone, but it's a pretty good bet. So if a murderer was committed and you were a suspect and your phone was at the scene at the time it happened, that's pretty incriminating. So Sam can do things like that. You know, he helps in the investigation that way. And he wants to be a real cop. He wants to shoot people and stuff.
That sounds cool, too. But even if you close the phone, I mean, there are people like myself, and I don't think it matters, that I turn off the GPS.
Oh,
but there's
something...
It doesn't matter?
Then it wouldn't track you. It wouldn't track you, I assume. I mean, I'm not an expert in stuff, but it would not track you if you turned it off. I didn't know you could turn off the GPS. But
I
if
think
you turned
you can
it off,
turn
I'm sure.
It off. I have, I have a brand new HR13 something or other from Verizon, and I pretty much didn't turn it on. But I know there's something that's called Find a Phone. That I learned all this lovely stuff. That you can, if somebody's on your contact list or you want to find, you can actually find their phone. And find them. So I guess they can do just about anything.
Oh, I don't know. I'm a dinosaur when it comes to that stuff. I mean, I just know enough to be able to put it in a book, but I have no idea.
I'm learning too many things lately, really. So, if Andy could, how does he deals with courtroom scenes and he deals with the prosecution? But he gets away with a lot of things. What would you say were his most strongest points? That if you know, you were going to do a character sketch, you know, I taught remedial reading and writing to kids, and I would tell them characters and teach them the different things about, you know, how to look deep into the story, not just the surface. What would you say his strongest points are? And then I want to talk about Willie and Sandra and how they help you come into the story, because I like those characters too.
Yeah, Andy's... I think his strength is his logic. He sees the big picture. Not something I necessarily do, but he sees the big picture. And he has a terrific memory. So, you know, he'll read discovery documents and pick up a slight thing that later he'll remember and he'll come back to help him. But basically his strength is to see the big picture, to not get caught in the minutiae that lawyers sometimes get caught up in. Willie and Sandra are, Willie was Andy's first client. He took on an appeal. His father asked him to before he died. He took on an appeal for Willie Miller, who was on death row for 7 years for a murder that he did not commit, as it turned out. And Andy gets him off. So what happened was Willie the people who actually did it and who framed Willie were hugely wealthy. And after Willie was freed, they brought a civil suit against these people, and I think Willie got like $10 million. So he didn't have to work. He was a street guy, and he didn't have to work. And the day they went to get the money, or the day they went to the settlement discussions or something, they saw a stray dog, and Willie got out of the car and ran and caught the dog. And they named, because of they were getting all this money, they named the dog Cash. So Andy, it was Willie's idea to start the Tara Foundation, because Willie didn't have to work, so he was going to run it for with Andy. And Sandra was, I don't really remember, this is so long ago, but Sandra was involved in one of the cases at one point, and she met Willie, and they got married, and you know, now they basically run the Tara Foundation. It's, Andy's there whenever he can, but when he's on a case, he doesn't have time. So Willie's Andy's partner. And Willie's a black belt in karate and very handy himself when it comes to, you know, physical stuff. So Willie becomes part of the ensemble, Andy's team.
Well, the other thing is that, I won't even tell you how many courtroom scenes Fran's read or how many fillers I've read. My husband counted the other day because he bought me a new computer, which I'm only allowed to use when he says I can use it. Yeah, I use it anyway. And he has my old one, and he went and counted how many reviews on the old one I have to transfer over to the new one or delete, and there are thousands. Seriously, I had no idea I read thousands of books, and I guess maybe I did. So I've read a lot of courtroom scenes, and I've read one or two novels that have actually emailed the publisher and said, I can't review this book because it's not credible. And some of the scenes were, one was where a police chief said he couldn't handle the case. He gave it to a retired police officer, and his wife was in the pit getting the bones out of the body. I was like, are you kidding me? So how do you create the opening statements in the court? How do you create the courtroom scenes? Because both he and Tasker said, I would like to, you know, thank you for your service, and that's probably the only way we're going to agree on it for the duration of the trial. He's like, yeah, okay.
I honestly,
the courtroom scenes, because they're so real. I feel like I'm in the courtroom and saying, let's just listen to Andy and, you know, just side with him. Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay.
Yeah, I keep answering the same way, but I have no idea. I just write it. You know, I mean, I was a movie executive. I was an executive in the movie business, not as a writer, for most of my adult life. So I sort of like never learned the writing craft. You know, I mean, I never took a course, but I never learned how to do that stuff. So I just sit down and do it. I don't know. Maybe, you know, other writers would be able to describe their process better, but I just can't. I mean, if I couldn't teach a 10-minute writing course. I don't know anything about it. I just know that I do it, you know, and I sit down and do it. So in terms of the courtroom stuff, I'm not a lawyer. You know, I don't think I've spent 15 minutes in a courtroom. So I just, like, you know, it just feels like common sense. And then I have a guy who's terrific. He wrote to me like after my fifth book. He's a lawyer, and he's a criminal defense attorney, and he is a former federal prosecutor. He's a guy who goes on these TV shows and, you know, gives opinions. So we became friends, by email friends. So now if I have a question I'm not sure about, or if I think, you know, there's something too stupid for Andy to get away with, I'll email him and ask him, you know, what he thinks. But basically, I just wing it.
That's what I just did for my new book, because I asked like five people to read it to see if I got my point across. I write from the point of view of the dead person behind the grave that did something wrong that deserves to be dead.
Uh-huh.
No, seriously. And it's huge. It's different. So I wish I had the same kind of contacts. There are a lot of people whose books I've read that are in law enforcement, FBI, and stuff like that. So I guess if I really needed to write something like that, I would ask them, but I don't. So
I'm always amazed at some authors, how much they know about stuff. Like, you know, like Michael Connelly, Lee Child, those guys. I mean, they know an amazing amount of things about what they're writing about. I just don't. I really don't.
Well, a lot of the authors that I review have contacts. I mean, Alan Jacobson wrote The Dark Side of the Moon, and he had people from NASA that actually helped him write it.
Yeah, but if you, I understand, but if you look at Michael Connelly's books,
he knows
that stuff. He's not getting, you know, otherwise on every page he'd be contacting somebody. I mean, he clearly has a complete grasp of the things he's writing about. You know, you could see it in the details. And, I mean, I admire that, but I can't match it, that's for sure.
Well, that's okay. You don't have to, because it's just as good. But before I forget...
No way, yeah.
It's a diplomacy. No, I'm a reading and writing staff developer specialist, so that was my thing, teaching kids with writing, and they thought I was a riot. And anything I did was, you know, off the wall and crazy, so they had fun. They never complained about writing.
Mm-hmm.
Next Tuesday, Brian Friedman, The Crooked Street, Frost Easton. On the 7th, Derek Volk, we're going to talk about Chasing the Rabbit and his son who has Asperger's, autism spectrum. On the 13th, this really blew my mind. It's like, I just hope it really happens. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child take center stage with the Verses for the Dead. They're coming on my show on that day. I was like, I'm so excited. And that, people, is going to be 12 o'clock. And on the 18th, Jessica Barry, Freefall. And what better way to end February than playwright, screenwriter, actor, and a whole bunch more, Herbie Pilato, and his book, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, about Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, wow. And that's just February. March gets even better. What can I say? So,
Doug Preston actually lives up here. He's a good guy.
Well, my husband once is like, how do you do this? Plus, my niece is going for nursing school, and I was up at 4 o'clock helping her do some research for her two discussions and her term paper. It's like, I'm learning a whole lot of things that I don't need to know, but it's fun. So if Andy could write a plot, who would he want to defend? Would he pick anybody specific that he would want to defend?
I mean, he does write a plot every year. So, you know, I mean.
he's allowing you to put it on typewriter on your computer,
yeah,
but he's writing it for you.
So,
right?
No, he just, all Andy cares about is that there's a dog involved and that he wants, and his client should believe that his client is innocent. It hasn't always worked out that way, but most of the times it does. And so he, you know, just an innocent client who's has some connection to dogs.
Well, that's the fun part. That's the unique part about your writing, is that there's something that's constant. I mean, I have a lot of authors. I mean, John Lesquoy uses Dip Miss Hardy. I love it. I mean, Steve Berry uses Cotton Malone. Joseph Finder has a character, but he just wrote The Rule of Law. You got to read it, people. That is unbelievable. Oh my God, is that good? That is really scary. But I mean, not everybody has a constant character, and I think the fact that there are dogs in the book, you know, it makes it even special. So I look forward to seeing, you know, what the dog is going to do to help you to win the case, help you to take the case or win the case. So you're very committed to rescue dogs. Is there any one specific dog that you have that's the most special?
One type of dog or one dog?
One specific dog that's the most special?
No, never.
They're all special.
Yes. I mean, some more than others, only because of circumstances. So we moved here in 2011 with 25 rescue dogs from California. Now, keep in mind that these are basically old dogs, right, or ill or so on. Anyway, we have two left from the original 25, 7 years later. So those two are, of course, very special to us. But I wouldn't say any stand out. You know, over time, maybe some, but no, it doesn't work that way. No, we're partial to Golden Retrievers, I would say, is our favorite. Although we also love, we have Mastiffs have been great for us, and Newfies and Bernese Mountain Dogs are amazing. But no one dog is special.
Are there any dogs that you don't have? Any specific dogs that wouldn't fit in with the rest of them?
Well, certainly we don't have any small dogs, but the only criteria, if somebody, mm-hmm. if a shelter calls us and says they have a large dog that needs to be placed that they can't place for whatever reason, illness, age, whatever the reason, the only thing that would prevent us from taking the dog would be if that dog doesn't get along with other dogs. That's a deal breaker. We can't have that. That's basically it. Anything else, any other kind of dog, it doesn't matter. It could be the most, you know, we, like I said, we have a pit bull mix. The temperament of the dog is what's important, and it's only important in terms of its ability to get along with other dogs. We don't have fights, and we can't afford to.
I just got a private message from someone that wants to know how he could listen to the show. I bet you don't know who that is. And I said, you could either listen for a couple of minutes or I can send you the link afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And you know who that is.
Terry.
Terry. I was wondering where he was, yeah. But this is another page. You see, I could keep the book in front of me. I can't do a review unless the book is in front of me. I mean, an interview. So
mm-hmm.
this part, really, for those people that love Andy Griffith, I love the Andy Griffith Show because it's old and whatever. How come you included that? So Wiki has learned about town trunks and fishing from the Andy Griffith Show reruns. So why shouldn't he be watching it? I think it's hilarious. I love Opie.
I'm sorry, what are you asking me?
How come you included that in the book? Because I thought that was really cool.
I have no idea. I think I told you this before we started, but mm-hmm. The books are written maybe a year before they come out, and mm-hmm. Maybe it's my advancing age, but I never remember them. I mean, I just never remember them. In fact, what happens is I write a book, and about 3 months later, I'll get the galleys from the publisher, to proofread. And I'm reading it like I'm reading it for the first time. Like, I don't know what's going to happen next. if there's a joke, I laugh. I wrote it, and I don't know what happened. So, I'm sure, I was familiar with the old Andy Griffith Show, so I'm sure I made a reference in there, but I just can't recall.
So what's coming after this particular one, Deck the Hounds, and what's coming after it? And there's somebody listening, he's actually listening, and he wants to know if it's okay if at the end of the show he says hello to you live. That's up to you.
No, it's up to you. But what's coming up next is a book called Black and Blue, which is part of that mm-hmm. Doug Brock series. And then in July is a book that I'm literally finishing today. It's an Andy mm-hmm. Carpenter book, and it's called Bark of Night. And then there'll be a Christmas book, like I say, which is just a gleam in my eye at this point. I have no idea what it's going to be about, but it'll be an Andy Carpenter.
Which police officers do you bring back in every single book? And when you hand in something, does the editor critique it? Does he change the plot or ask you to change it ever? Or to change a scene?
In police officers, I think there's a couple I bring back. Certainly Andy's best friend, Pete Stanton, is in all the books, either as a cop or as a friend. I have a great editor at my publisher, and I send it to her. And she gives me notes, and I make changes, and we talk about it. But it's a fairly quick process. If you like my books,
mm-hmm.
if someone would like my books and find them unique, the thing that they would like and find unique would be the voice, the way Andy talks,
mm-hmm.
Andy's sound, and
mm-hmm.
that's very hard to edit. You can't. That is what it is. So my editor makes no effort to edit that. All she's
mm-hmm.
doing is looking at plot things that don't make sense and mistakes I might have made, and I always make mistakes, So, I mean, I wrote in Airtight.
Mm-hmm.
This got in the book. I wrote in Airtight mm-hmm. that they found the victim lying face down on his back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm very capable of making
mm-hmm.
stupid mistakes like that.
Well, you know what? It's funny because I won't tell you whose book it is. I read something the other day, and I sent a note to the publicist, and I said, I realize that this is an unedited copy. And the book isn't coming out for a while, but there's a character mistake. The name of the character is spelt wrong. The last name of this particular character, who's a major character in the book, is spelled wrong. I said, and I picked it up on this particular page. Well, they change it or not, I don't know. And there was one.
No, I do stuff like that all the time.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
my
there
editor
was one
catches,
author
but the editor catches most of them, you know. And then after the editor, who's looking at the big picture, she's, you know, she's looking for plot structure and that kind of stuff. After she does it, then they have copy editors that go over it. And then when the galleys are printed, I proofread it and the copy editors proofread it again, and there's still, you know, still mistakes. It's just, I don't know why, but I can't help it.
Well, I didn't find any in your book, but I do. I have
well,
found
look
in
more
quite
carefully.
A few. Quite a few books. As a matter of fact, it was really bad because in one particular book, and I won't say who it is, the author is very, very famous, I found like 50 typos. And I'm going like, if they don't fix these, he's going to get a, you know, some really bad reviews. So one question before somebody says hello live on the air, how did you pick the cover for this book? It's so cute. All those dogs, I love them with the little hats on them. They're so cute.
On Deck the Hounds?
How did you pick the cover for this? This is so
cool.
I don't.
My publisher does it, and they send it to me. And
really?
Yeah. I never have anything to do with it. I mean, I guess theoretically I could say, no, I don't like it, and maybe they would change it, but they're pretty good at it, so I just go with it. You know, and the Christmas ones are, like, ultra cute.
This is so cute.
Yeah.
These are so cute. Aww.
Yeah.
And then what about the front cover? I mean, there's nothing, they don't give away anything, but I've read books where the front cover literally led me to not have to read the book because I knew who did it.
Oh, and in my case, it's the opposite, actually, because what happens is because I don't know what the story is before I start, right? I mean, it just goes where it goes. And they do the book jackets well before I'm done with the book. So very often the book jacket is not relevant to the book. It doesn't tell you what the book's about because they didn't know what the book was about when they did the jacket. So my situation would be the opposite of that.
Well, somebody wants to say hello. Hi there, how are you?
Hey, David.
Hey, Terry.
I'm calling on behalf of your Boca Raton fan club. This is Terry.
Who's Terry?
Terry Bresnik,
yes,
how you doing?
Good, I know which Terry. How are you, Terry?
Good.
For anybody who's listening, Terry's an old friend. He's an incredible admirer of me. He was jealous of me throughout high school. And
well, I just wanted to be sure you had at least one person listening to your interview.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Having a good time down here. When are you coming down for your next visit? We have a Patterson Day coming up in February.
But it's small now, right? I was saying actually earlier in an interview, it used to be just like this huge event. And now it's just for mostly people who live there already?
That's pretty much so. Yeah, our parents' generation, once they died off, they stopped coming.
Yeah, I was down there, as you know, but I was down there briefly, and of course the dogs are starting to bark. I was in and out, but I may get down there again for one of the next two books.
Good.
So I will definitely call you.
I saw your ad for the new book. Look forward to reading them.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay, good talk.
Well,
good
Terry,
you've
got to come up to
Thanks,
New York
friend.
So I could, you know, join your breezy corners, whatever. I haven't seen it. So, David, where can everybody find out about you? Where can everybody find out about you and your novels?
By listening to your show. I have a website. I have a website and a Facebook page. But my website is cleverly named davidrosenfeld.com.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And
just
when am I getting
that.
Black and blue? I want that. So what do I send to Hector?
Yes.
I know,
Hector is the guy.
Loves me.
Yeah, I know.
He's also set up something with Philip Margolin for March 7th.
Uh-huh.
So everybody, Terry, how's the weather down there? Because it's freezing up here, but it's sunny. How is it in Florida?
50-60 rainy all weekend. It's a cold spell we're having here, but it's supposed to get nice by the end of the week, just in time for me to – I'll be up in New York this week, get a little chilly.
Well, when you come up to New York and you're around my area, you got to tell me so we can all get together and have another breezy corners up in New York. But I want to thank David.
I will.
This has been this has been fun, and the dogs have really been good. I'm very proud of you guys. You're going to get gold stars, gold barks today.
Wait, one personal aside. Terry, do me a favor. I'm going to be in New York. Email me.
Okay.
All right, you have my email address, right?
Yeah, I have your email address. I'll let you know what's going on.
Okay.
That is so cool.
All right.
Everybody, this has been fun. Everybody have
Thanks,
a great
Fran.
Day. David, thank you. Terry, thank you. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
So long.
Oh, my God.